During this hour of the show, we'll take your questions about personal finance, something we do once a month on the show, on the third Friday at 10 o'clock. Our guest, David Sinnoh, he's been with us for a long time. He's professor of finance here at the University of Illinois and has a very broad and deep background in a number of different areas of personal finance and money management. We also have a special guest today who is visiting from California. John Misetich is a professor of finance at the University of California at San Diego. He's also here as an adjunct professor at the University of Illinois Department of Finance, and he teaches a class here for 8 weeks in spring semester, so we're glad to have him with us as well. John Misetich is also a professional money manager. He's president and CEO of Kensington Financial in San Diego. And he's also a graduate of the University of Illinois, so this is somewhat of a homecoming, I guess, on a regular basis here for him. He's also a recent recipient of the Distinguished Service Award from the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences here at the University of Illinois. We'll talk with both of them during this hour. As we do that, we invite you into the conversation. All you need to do is pick up the telephone and call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest. Actually, if you're listening online, anywhere in the continental U.S., the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And your questions are welcome. And to both of you, good morning.
Well, good morning, Jack. It's always a pleasure to be with you. And first, what I would like to do is wish the WILL family and, of course, all of our listeners a very healthy new year and a financially successful new year as well. I'd like to take just a couple of minutes before John jumps in and talk a little bit about something, oh, dear to all of our hearts, and that's taxes, and more specifically, Social Security taxes. A lot of us pay those Social Security taxes, especially for those of us who work in the private sector, and you'll all be delighted to know that the wage base, the maximum wage base now for paying Social Security taxes has jumped to $90,000, and everyone gets to pay 6.2% of the first $90,000 they make for Social Security taxes to support the Social Security system. And mathematically, that translates to $5,580. And of course, if you are employed in the private sector, your employer as well gets to pay that identical sum. And of course, for Medicare and hospitalization insurance, that adds another 1.45%. So the total payroll taxes really start at 7.65%. Now, we've heard a lot in the news lately that Mr. Bush, President Bush, of course, wants to, quote unquote, reform the Social Security system. I think that really means taking younger people and allowing them to take a portion of their Social Security payments that they would have to pay into the regular system and essentially privatize them and put them in their own bank for purposes of investing them, typically in stocks, perhaps an index like the S&P 500 index. Now, the reason I bring this up, interestingly enough, is that President Bush has recently appointed six individuals in the United States to really look into this thing, mostly people from the private sector, sort of a blue ribbon commission, to directly report to President Bush and his committee to make changes. And what I am happy to report, regardless of whether or not changes are made, is that one of our very own from the University of Illinois, Professor Jeffrey Brown, Department of Finance, is one of these six members. Professor Brown has spent literally a number of years studying this. He's been a member of many, many other governmental commissions in Washington, D.C., and I know Professor Brown personally, and I can say two things about him. One is he's a tremendously bright individual, and two, he has lots and lots of common sense. So, and when I talk to Professor Brown, I always say to him, you know, I'm holding you personally responsible for my Social Security benefits that I expect to receive at least when I'm 65, if I ever retire from the University of Illinois. So we're going to follow that story, and I think it's going to be very interesting to see what kind of input Professor Brown has to that. You know, there are so many topics, Jack, that we can talk about, and I want John to jump in. We're going to talk about interest rates. We're going to talk about themes of investing for the year 2005. So on that basis, John, I think I'm going to turn things over to you. Perhaps you can wax eloquent for maybe 2, 3, 4 minutes, and then we'll start taking calls from our listeners.
Well, thank you, David. I'll try my best here. I'd like to cover 3 points this morning. First, let's do an overall review of the year 2004.
Okay.
You know, the Sinatra song goes, it was a very good year. Indeed, it was a very good year. And let me just read you some rates of return here. The S&P 500 index, generally considered to be a more representative stock index than the Dow Jones Industrial Average, all these numbers I'm going to read you include the reinvestment of dividends. S&P 500 last year was up 10.88%. The Dow Jones lagged a little bit at 5.3%. The NASDAQ index up about 8.6% with the dividends, maybe a little over 9%. And foreign stocks, using the EAFE index, E-A-F-E, that's Europe, Australia, Far East, up an astounding 18.6%. The bond market, not too bad. We kind of held our own. Bonds were up, or bond funds, anywhere between 4 and 5%. A balanced portfolio, let's say you had about 60% in stocks and about 40% in bonds, you made about 9.33%. Money market funds, about 0.8%. And if you were in a one-year certificate of deposit, you made about 1.5%. And finally, gold was up 5%. Now, all of that is a very good year. We certainly can't complain about those kinds of rates of return. But I want to interject two cautionary notes here. Let's go back to foreign stocks, or maybe to use the more polite term, international stocks. I want to read you some returns that were made in the foreign markets last year. Mexico up 47%. Austria up 58%. Norway up 39%. Belgium up 31%. Ireland up 26%. Indonesia up 45%. Interestingly, China down about 16%, and we could talk more about that later. So the question is, you know, why such high returns abroad? What happened last year specifically to get these astounding returns? Well, I think about half of the variation can be explained by the fact that the dollar went down, or conversely, the euro and the yen went up. Let me give you three examples. In the U.K., in local currency terms, that is in pound terms, the U.K. made 16.9%. That's the FTSE 100 index. 16.9, pretty good. But in that was in dollar terms, 16.9%. But in local currency terms, it was only 8.9. So with the dollar going down or the euro going up, it was like having the wind at your back. And finally, Germany, in dollar terms, made a very decent 14.3%, but in local currency terms, it only made 5.9%. So the fall in the dollar or the rise in the euro actually just about tripled the rate of return in German stocks. So I would say caution. Things that go up 15 to 20% per year. In fact, the average was 18.6% for the world stock markets overall. It really can't last. Nothing goes up 18, 19% per year. And finally, I just want to interject another cautionary note here on real estate. We could talk about all kinds of real estate, but the one that I deal with, real estate securities, otherwise known as real estate investment trusts or REITs, they also had an astounding year. If I use the Vanguard REIT Index Fund as a proxy, REITs were up 30.7% last year. And get this, over the last 4 years, REITs are up a cumulative total of 107% over 4 years. On an annual compounded basis, that's 20% per year.
That's pretty good, John. I like those numbers.
Those are very good numbers. But again, caution, it can't last. So I'd be very cautious. I wouldn't necessarily sell. In fact, I would not sell. If you have a lot of REITs and a lot of international stocks right now, I probably would not sell too many of them, if any at all. But I certainly would not make a big commitment to either asset class.
Okay, so you wouldn't certainly add to those asset classes?
I think if you have a reasonable allocation right now, and for foreign stocks, for example, I did a little research before the program, and if you look at what Vanguard is saying, a very fine mutual fund group, they're saying that a reasonable allocation in the foreign stock markets is somewhere between 10 and 20% of your non-house net worth, somewhere between 10 and 20%. So my recommendation would be that if you're already in that 10 to 20% range, just hold steady. I would not chase performance. You know, don't get carried away by the 30, 40, 50% returns that were made in a lot of these foreign markets last year. Just be content that you did it, and maybe just hold in there at that 10 to 20% of net worth. And the same for real estate.
And, you know, what's interesting about that, John, is I was watching television last night, and fortunately the Illini seemed to eke out a victory. Congratulations to the Illini. I was looking at some of the television advertising that appeared and the national spots. And one of the national spots was a well-known mutual fund company, which I won't mention particularly over the air, but an outstanding mutual fund company. And what they did is they took three or four of their very, very top funds and showed these amazing performances. Mm-hmm. And obviously that commits and convinces people to chase those kinds of returns, specifically what you're suggesting we shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, this is a classic investment mistake, to chase return, a high return over the past 1 year, 2 years, or 3 years. A lot of mutual fund companies, I think most of them do a pretty good job, especially Vanguard. I'll be very unabashed about that. I think Vanguard is clearly the cream of the crop. And they're actually one of the few fund groups that probably do just the opposite. They do not chase performance, and they tell their investors that after an astounding year of 15 to 20% gains, that maybe they ought to be a little cautious. And that's very unusual to find talk like that from a mutual fund group.
Okay. Well, there you have it, a few trends and issues to start our conversation. We're talking about personal finance this morning. We have a couple callers waiting and would welcome others. Our guests again, David Sinnoh, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. He joins us once a month. And also special guest John Masetich. He's professor of finance at the University of California, San Diego. He's also an adjunct professor of finance here at the University of Illinois, so he's visiting the campus. We'll be happy to take your questions. We have a couple people waiting and a couple lines open. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a Champaign listener first on line number one. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, David and John. I'm so glad when you guys are on together. I think of you as the dynamic duo.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I wish you could do this more often together. I do have one question. My husband and I are about 5 years pre-retirement, and we recently made a nice profit upon selling the house, and we're possibly interested in investing in a small second home or condo in a nicer climate, but we aren't quite sure what to do with the profit on selling our home, and right now it's just sitting there because we just aren't sure. Could you advise both of you, please?
Okay, let me jump in and understand something. This was your personal residence?
Yes.
All right. And I presume this was a personal residence in Champaign County?
Yes.
All right. Probably you didn't make $500,000 of capital gain on it, but hopefully, as you said, you made some profit. So as you know, under current tax law, if you have been living in your primary residence for a substantial period of time, really more than 2 years, and you sell it at a gain, which presumably you did, number one, you avoid income tax. So that's the good news. So there are no taxes due on the profit from the sale of your residential home. So that's important. Now, the next question was talking about probably taking some of this profit and buying a second home or condo. Is that what we're talking about?
Uh-huh.
Now, what are you doing for a primary residence? Did you rebuy a primary residence as well? All
just
right.
Downsized.
Oh, good. Yeah. Good. No children in the house now?
No children.
All right. Well, you've downsized, and now you want to take an amount of money and consider a second home. Let me ask you, without telling me the dollar amount, do you have a substantial amount of money set aside, or would you be looking to procure a mortgage on a second home?
Probably the latter.
Okay. And would you be willing to rent the second home?
Yes.
All right. So this would be something that you would use just occasionally,
yes,
or sometime later on in later
on,
years?
Yeah, well, occasionally for a little bit and then perhaps more time.
Okay. Well, there are a number of rules that you have to be aware of besides the issues of geography and cost, and that is that typically if you use your second home as a rental property, then there are some tax deduction issues that you have to know about. Generally, you can always deduct interest. You can always deduct real estate taxes. But, of course, if you rent it, you will have to report income, and you may not be able to depreciate this property if you spend more than a couple of weeks a year in this property. Are you likely to do that?
I don't think so.
Okay. So I always like the concept where you buy a property in another area and you turn it into an income property and you occasionally go there. In fact, if you even go there, you might rent somewhere else or stay in a hotel so you can truly treat it as a rental income property. And moreover, it may not be your dream property, but at least it probably will keep up with inflation in that particular area. And I think that's really the key with a second home, that you buy something in an area that you're interested in. And it is, as I said, it may not be the dream house, but at least it keeps up with inflation as other real estate goes up. Is that sort of the plan?
Right.
Okay, good. Now, having said that, is there an area of the country you're interested in?
Not any certain area, just a little warmer. So, you know, we're flexible.
Okay, well, you know, things get expensive the further south you go. Or the further west you go. John, we were just talking about this on the West Coast. It's just unbelievable to touch anything. Do you have any suggestions in the West Coast where things are reasonable, for example?
Well, I'd probably stay out of San Diego, to be frank about it. The prices are just astounding. And you know, people go to cocktail parties today. We used to talk about the stock market. That ended about 5 years ago. All we talk about is the, you know, the astounding price of real estate. The average price in San Diego is about $500,000, and you don't get much for $500,000. You might find a condo maybe for $400,000, $450,000. But I would like to add one thing, you know, in your decision-making process. There's a wealth of research on this whole idea of buying property and where to buy it, and that is there's a Professor Rosenberg at UC Berkeley who says that the main determinant of housing appreciation is job creation in the area that you're buying. You know, is the economy creating jobs? You know, is there net job creation, jobs created minus jobs lost? So I would start maybe with the local chamber of commerce or, you know, get on the web and try to find some information like that about the area that you're considering. It'd be very positive if you can find an area that's actually creating jobs, because then I think it would enhance your chances of actually making money on the property. Not that you're buying this necessarily, you know, just to make money. The way you described it, I think this is more for personal reasons.
Yes.
Yeah. But secondarily, of course, you know, you do want, at least, as David was saying, to keep up with inflation. So I would really focus on job creation in the area.
And I agree with that wholeheartedly. And there are some interesting areas in Tennessee, if you've ever even considered Tennessee. The Knoxville area is a very, very good area for job creation. It is growing, and prices are still reasonable in that area. So that would be one area that I would look at if I was going to buy a second home or a condo. Now, naturally, that's not quite as warm as maybe you're thinking. Mm-hmm. But there are, interestingly enough, even further south, in certain areas of Florida, interior areas of Florida are growing and prices are still reasonable. So again, I think John is absolutely correct, and I echo that 100%. You want to look at areas where there is net job growth.
Thank you. And if I didn't invest it in the house, what would be the best thing to do with the profit?
Oh, that's a tough one, because now if you're not going to invest in real estate, then you're going to invest in securities, and you're either going to invest in fixed income or stocks. And right now, that's a tough one. A lot of people are sitting on the sidelines with cash. I would be very, very loath to suddenly throw a lot of money in the stock market, especially after a very good year. So I would certainly dollar cost average, if I was going to do that, into a series of indexes. And probably with that money, if I was really thinking of utilizing it for a down payment, I probably would err on the side of conservatism and buy short-term fixed income probably right now, or even some money markets, and maybe a 20 to 25% dollar cost averaging into stocks. John, I don't know.
I would agree. And also, if you want to just keep it, you know, in something safe like certificates of deposit, a lot of brokerage firms, you may have a brokerage account. I would start with your broker rather than your bank. And a lot of brokerage firms, especially the big national ones like Charles Schwab or Fidelity or Vanguard, will scour the whole country and try to get you the best CD rate. So right now, you could probably get something, I don't know, maybe a 6 to 9 month CD for 2.5 to 2.8% through a broker. And if that doesn't work, then certainly try your bank. But I think maybe 6 to 9 months out, I think David and I are in agreement that interest rates are going to go up this year. So I wouldn't lock it up for maybe not much longer than 6 to 9 months.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call. We have several people waiting. We'll go next to an Urbana listener on line number 2. Good morning. Yeah, is a caller there?
Yep.
Okay.
I wanted to discuss a question about research. A lot of commentators, in describing any given situation, will often say, this is like the situation of a certain time, a certain place that they've lived through or that they've researched. But it's all anecdotal. And it made me think that the physical sciences, many years ago, began with descriptions. Something is like something else. The biological sciences began with cataloging, describing, measuring. And a lot of the mathematics of modern finance, when you boil it down, is just complex description rather than prediction. At this point, are there any research numbers, any research descriptors that have been found to be pretty good at actually saying one time period, one event, one market movement is actually like another one, that there's a fundamental measurement that describes them and, in effect, predicts how quickly they will shift from their current to the next position? This all begins, of course, because in 2001, I looked at what was happening and I told myself, wait 18 months calmly, because that's on average how long it takes for things to rearrange and get back to where it was to continue on whatever track it had been. And, of course, we're way past 18 months and we're nowhere near back to where we were. So I'm just wondering whether anecdotes is all we've got, and clever and sophisticated observers, or if we've got any predictors that actually measure one thing that is comparable to another in terms of how soon it gets back to where it had been before an interruption or disruption. And if that doesn't make any sense, it's okay.
No, it makes some good sense. I think there is some very good scientific data that has been mined, and that data is typically referred to as the Ibbotson data. Roger Ibbotson has gone back with his team and dissected years and years and years of stock market returns and sort of analyzed them 100,000 different ways in terms of data mining. So there is some decent numbers out there. Now, what's going to happen tomorrow, you and I both know that past performance is no predictive notion of what's going to happen in the future. On the other hand, we can go back to approximately 75 years of returns in the stock market, and we can reach some reasonable conclusions. And that is that over long, long periods of time, stock outperform fixed income. And some stocks do better than others, and you can't be wedded to one asset class. Now, that certainly is a key. The other factor is that despite 70 years of world wars, depressions, the fall and rise of communism, terrorism, etc., over long, long periods of time, stocks inexorably seem to rise. They seem to go up. At the same time, things regress to the mean. We know that as well. So I think that was John's point earlier, that we can't expect another year or two like we saw in 2004. But I think probably the best data to really study is the Ibbotson data. And to defend the science of finance, it has become much more mathematical. It is much more a modeling type of science as opposed to merely descriptive. But your points are certainly well taken.
Yeah, and I'd like to just follow up on that, too. I'm reminded of a quote from Mark Twain, who, that great investment advisor, of course, who said that history does not repeat itself, but it rhymes. I love that quote. In relation to the stock and the bond market, I think there is some predictability about P.E. ratios. It's not a perfect predictor, but right now, if you look at the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones, we have a P.E., a reasonable P.E., I think it's a reasonable P.E. of about 20 to 1. Now, the historical record would indicate that the norm is about 15 to 1. So, you know, 20 divided by 15, that would indicate that we're about one-third perhaps overvalued. But I would argue that you can't really look at the historical norm going back 50 years because that included the Great Depression, you know, the war, World War II, and so forth. We are more productive today. I think that stocks do deserve a higher valuation. So I personally think that 20 is a reasonable valuation level for stocks. I could be proven wrong on that. On the other hand, I think it's quite the opposite for the bond market. Bond interest rates right now, if you take the 10-year Treasury note, which is the benchmark, I think the yield yesterday was 4.16, 4.17, 4.2%. We are near a 45-year low. I mean, that is just astounding to even think about it. So I would say, based on history, that the likely direction of interest rates is up. We're at a 45-year low. It just can't last. Warren Buffett was quoted in the paper the other day saying the exact same thing, that he thought that he thought two things, that the dollar will certainly fall a bit more, and that interest rates would probably go up. You know, and I think he was talking, you know, mainly about basing this mainly on the historical record.
We're a little past our midpoint here, talking about personal finance on Focus 580 with our guest David Sinnoh, professor of finance at the University of Illinois, and also joining us, special guest John Masetich, professor of finance at the University of California, San Diego, also adjunct professor here at the University of Illinois. And we have a couple callers waiting. Actually, our lines are almost full. We have one line open, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Crawfordsville, Indiana, line number 4. Good morning.
Hi. The previous caller had a similar question to mine. I was going to ask you if you knew of any place we could read or any good books that would help us understand secular megatrends in the market. I think what I had down here that from 82 to year 2000, we were in a secular bull, and from 1966 to 82, it was a secular bear. Within that long-term trend, there's some cyclical bulls and bears, but it does seem over the last century that the market has moved in these long-range trends, and I didn't know why and whether that is a good predictor. And I noticed you mentioned the Ibbotson data. What I was going to ask you was, is there any good books about that would help us understand? Because I can remember John Bogle said one thing you want to remember is tomorrow is never like yesterday. And so that is there any other data other than the Ibbotson that you could think of that would help an ordinary, not an economist, but a citizen understand these secular trends?
Well, I could recommend a couple of books there's a William Bernstein, mm-hmm. and I've used his book in my San Diego course.
Uh-huh.
He's got about three of them on the market right now.
Uh-huh.
And he doesn't talk about megatrends per se, but I think he discusses in depth some of the things, you know, more or less that you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And I'm drawing a blank on the name of the books, but if you just get on the web and do a Google search.
I've seen some of his. Now, does he have his own mutual fund? Is he connected with
them? No, he does not. He's totally independent. And here's a really interesting thing about Dr. Bernstein. He is an MD.
Uh-huh.
And you would think, an MD, what does he know about finance? Well, he also has a PhD in finance.
Uh-huh.
And he's written extensively on the subject. And I think that his readings are some of the best I've ever come across. William Bernstein, okay. Bernstein.
Because I know there's a Peter Bernstein.
Yeah, and he's also very good.
Uh-huh.
And he's really an expert on risk and return.
Uh-huh.
And he really does a great historical survey of that whole subject. So I would definitely recommend both Bernsteins.
Okay. All right. One other quick question to change the pace. It has to do with taxes. My personal taxes this year changed a little bit in that there's about $17,000 in farming income that came into the family.
Yes.
And that's a little less than half of my total income. So am I under that rule where farmers have to get their taxes in by the end of February?
Right.
And normally I would be as an employee, it's always been April 15th. Has that changed for me? To be specific, it's about $17,000 worth of farming income and $27,000 worth of income from an employer and interest and dividends. So it's a little less than half, and I didn't know if there's a cutoff point there where farmers have to get their income taxes in by the end of February.
You know, I'm sorry, I just don't know the answer to that question.
Uh-huh.
You stumped me. You need to ask your farm advisor or your tax advisor on that question.
Okay.
But you're asking a good question.
Yeah, it's changed for me because I've inherited a family farm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's a positive thing. I wanted to make one more comment about megatrends and the periods of time from 1966 to 1982. You've got to remember during that period of time, when I think of that period of time, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but I believe we're talking about periods of very, very high inflation.
That's right.
Periods of high interest rates, very, very major shocks to the commodity system in America. And those things are negative for stocks and negative for companies. It's tougher to make money during those periods of time. So that sort of era, if you will, if you're subscribing to dramatic increases in inflation, dramatically higher interest rates, you could look certainly for poorer performance in the equity markets, no questions about it, and perhaps even poorer performances in the real estate market that you were talking about earlier. It could put enormous pressure on just purchasing real estate because of those high interest rates, which means that real estate would fall because demand would fall. Price probably would fall. So if you felt that we were moving into that era, the difficult part is that what's happening? And that's the tough part, to figure out how high are interest rates going to go, what the Fed is going to meet next month. Well, I guess it's a foregone conclusion that they're going to raise the Fed funds rate another 0.25%. Heck, they've done it already 5 times over the last, 14 months? So we're now looking at a prime rate of 5.25, a Fed funds rate of, 2.25? It used to be 1. Even the Fed and Greenspan have said it's still a little bit too low. So, yes, we're going to see rising interest rates. We saw the CPI, at least reported by the government, over the last 12 months at 3.3%. A lot of people would argue it's higher than that, but that's the governmental numbers that are reported. So if one felt we were moving into higher fields of inflation, higher fields of interest rates, then clearly we could have some tough times in real estate and some of these equity markets.
And I'll add one thing to that. I definitely agree with David that we should be a little cautious here because of rising interest rates. I don't think there's any question. Well, I guess there's always some question, but I think it's highly likely that rates are going to rise this year. But the other half of the equation when it comes to stock prices is earnings. You know, stock prices are a function of two things, the level of interest rates and changes in corporate earnings. And on the earnings side, this is a really, really positive story the last few years. And I think that story will continue this year. Earnings have been going up at about a 15 to 20% on an annual rate. The forecast this year among the people that I respect is an increase maybe in the 10 to 12% range in corporate earnings. And that's still very good. So even though we could have an increase of maybe 1% in interest rates, 1 percentage point, it could be totally counteracted by a 10 to 12% increase in earnings.
And I think that's the bet the Fed is making. They're thinking and believing that they can raise interest rates and not hemorrhage, if you will, the earnings from these major companies.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, speaking of earnings, so are you saying even though earnings will possibly go down a little bit this year, since they are still positive and good, that wouldn't necessarily make the market go down? Because I hear a lot of talk in the media about earnings will be less this year, and that's pushing
down. I'm saying quite the opposite. I'm saying that earnings will actually still increase this year by perhaps 10%. Standard & Poor's, in New York, a very fine research organization for both stocks and bonds, their official forecast was about a 9 or 10% increase in earnings for the 500 stocks in the S&P 500 index. That's a very healthy increase. The historical norm is about 6%, by the way, a 6% increase in earnings. And they're saying this year we should still have about a 9 or 10% increase in earnings. So that's definitely over the historical norm. And I personally think that'll be enough to counteract the deleterious effect of rising interest rates. So it's a combination of the two, changes in interest rates and changes in earnings. I'm mildly bullish for what that's worth.
Okay. Now, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Since you are an owner of farmland, what's the outlook for increased prices per acre in farmland in your area in 2005?
I don't have that outlook. I suppose Purdue University would have it. I couldn't tell you, but I would think that would be from the commodity prices themselves. It would be a function of how well the price of corn and beans increased or decreased, and I don't think that looks very positive at this time.
Have you made a decision in 2005 what kind of allocation you're making between corn and beans?
Yes, we know what kind of rotation we're going to use,
okay.
And But as far as the land prices themselves, other than being a function of grain prices, I wouldn't know. It has to do a lot with the location if you're
sure.
near a big city and
sure.
all that.
It sure does.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a pleasure visiting with you.
Okay, well, great show, and you've been very helpful. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much for the call. A couple callers waiting. We'll go next to someone who has been waiting very patiently on line number three, another Indiana caller. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Couple of things. The first thing, do you know a website or perhaps a book I could get from a library where I could, I've been taking advantage of these recent balance transfers and credit cards, and I'm getting them down to the place now where I think they're going to be concerned about whether they ought to be doing this since the prime is getting very close to one that I pay. And what I like to do is plug in the same amount each month for a long period of time and plug in what the annual percentage rate is, and then I find out how many months it takes me to, say, take care of $5,000. Do you know of any algorithm
yes.
like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would go to bankrate.com.
Bankrate,
all one word, bankrate.com.
Okay.
I visited that website many times, and it covers a number of things, car loans, equity loans, mm-hmm. mortgage loans,
mm-hmm.
you know, various credit card companies and what the interest rates are and so forth.
Okay.
It'd be a very good place to start.
Okay. Now, the second question, if it's a proper one, is there a way to treat Social Security when you first start in the system? And what is it, 6.62 now percent, whatever it is, and then your employee matches that. And looking at that like a stock you just put away and never touched until you retired, is there a percentage that we're getting? Say we're making 3% off of our quote-unquote investment into Social Security?
No, you're making about 1.4.
1.4.
We're compounded. That seems to be the national rate.
And
think you could do better on your own?
I have no interest in doing that, honest with you, because I listen to financials. People talk all the time. And I come in this in from mathematics. And I just realize in the long run, unless you have a large research group, you know, checking everything out.
Absolutely.
It's just a roll of the dice. And so I've just put my money away, and I'm thinking about doing the TIPS thing, but I don't even know if I want to do that yet because it saves me just a lot of hassle now that I'm retired, and
mm-hmm.
I'm starting to really, really understand retirement now.
Are you enjoying it?
Huh?
Are you enjoying it?
Oh, yes.
Well,
yeah.
That's the most important
thing. I get to listen to the fellow there and Inge and all kinds of people. I don't watch much TV, and I look at old movies I've taped over the years from the 30s and the 40s that I like and okay. things like that.
Could
you answer this question then? Why did they choose 1.9% put away from your Social Security obligation to start these private funds? Is there anything remarkable in terms of is it, you know, if you did 1.7, you're not going to get as good, and if you go 2.3, you're taking more risk or what?
Well, I think
thanks a lot.
I don't know the answer to that question. That probably is in the hands of what? The Social Security folks or the gods? It's just not sure. And, of course, that whole situation is so much in flux. John, I wanted to ask you, is bank rate, is it B-A-N-K or B-A-N-C?
B-A-N-K.
Okay, so it's B-A-N-K, R-A-T-E. rate.com. So that's important. And also, for people who want to go out and spend about $30 on their own, which I force all of my finance students to do, and that is to have them buy a Texas Instrument calculator. It's called a BA2+. It's one of the few calculators that is reasonably user-friendly and actually comes with a document that one can understand how to use this crazy calculator. And it does wonderful things like loan calculations, principal balances at the end of any period. So it's an amazing little toy, and it's an amazing little financial instrument for about $30, $35. So again, that is another choice, and it's certainly a worthwhile expenditure. There's all kinds of good things that you can do with it.
Okay. Did you want to add something?
Yeah, I'd like to you mentioned TIPS. I think TIPS are something to seriously consider. These are inflation-protected bonds issued by the Treasury, and you are guaranteed to stay ahead of inflation. Whatever the yield is on the TIPS, which is not – I grant you, is not very high right now, 1-point-something, but the inflation rate or the consumer price index will be added to that. But I would say maybe wait a few months, 6 to 12 months, when we see higher interest rates, and then buy your TIPS.
Okay. We have about 10 minutes left and one caller standing by. We do have time for others if you'd like to join us. We're talking about personal finance, again with David Sinnoh, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois, and John Misetich from the University of California, San Diego, Finance Department. He's visiting here as an adjunct professor at the University of Illinois Department of Finance. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. And we have an Urbana listener on line number one. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi there.
Hi, I have a question that I don't seem to be getting really good advice on. My situation, I'm 29, full-time employed, and recently got out of grad school. So I'm just first time in my life finding myself a little bit of money that I don't need to spend for, you know, basic needs. I'm doing my IRA and my retirement savings through work, but I'm thinking about what I want to do in terms of longer-term investing. And I'm at the point, you know, the old advice is to buy a house, you know, because that's something that you'll have and it'll grow, et cetera, but in that way your rent is going to, you know, to you. Well, for me, I'm looking at a situation where within the next year, I'm probably going to be working for a company that's going to expatriate me, so I don't actually need a house in the U.S. But a lot of other expats I know buy houses and keep them and rent them out, and I'm just wondering, is that really the best thing to do, or should that, if you don't need the house, should the money go into longer-term investments?
Those are great questions, and I would be very loath and very hesitant to go into the rental income property business if you are out of the country. Simple,
right.
Simple. I couldn't recommend it, period. Number two, you are presumably contributing to a Roth IRA on your own?
Yes.
Are you doing that? And
yeah,
you are also contributing at the maximum that your company will allow you to into what, your 401k? And you have some type of company match at your 401k?
It's not until I'm vested. I'm actually a university employee.
Okay, so then if you're a university employee, you're eligible to do a 403b. Are you doing that currently?
Well, I actually just got converted from hourly to full time, so
okay.
I haven't made my decision yet.
All right. Well, number one, by all means, with after-tax income, you have the right in 2005, unless you make just a tremendous amount of money, you could put in $4,000 in 2005 uh-huh. into your own Roth IRA, a great idea.
Which I'm already planned for that.
Okay, and interestingly enough, if you did sometime decide to buy a house, get a load of this. You can take $10,000 out of your Roth IRA and apply it for a down payment on a home with no tax impact, so long as you're a first-time home buyer. So
okay.
Keep that in mind. Number two, I presume after the Roth and after you participated the 403B at the university that you need to have some emergency funds. Are you putting aside some emergency funds?
Just starting.
Okay.
I'm just starting to make all of these decisions.
Okay. So if you're going to put aside some emergency funds do not go into the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
They go into short-term investments like money market funds at a bank or a mutual fund, perhaps short-term certificates of deposit. So your next job after Roth IRAs and contributing into a 403B is to build up emergency funds. That's your next job. I don't know, John, if you agree with that or not.
I do.
All right.
I even have one specific suggestion.
Before I even think about a house.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I don't have any problem if you're going to be expatriated. I have no problem with you not owning a house, especially in central Illinois. In central Illinois, I would suggest to you that that bets are off with the kind of inflation that you would receive from your house, let alone the cost of maintaining that house, versus not having those housing expenses. I think you'd be well ahead.
Yeah, I don't think you want to be an absentee landlord. I have a number of clients, maybe a third of my clientele, who live abroad, you know, Europe, Asia, all over the world. And I tell you, in almost every case where they have bought a property that they and rented it out, and they thought they were going to come back and live in this property. It always turned out bad. Something goes wrong. You're 3,000 miles from home. You have a bad renter. You know, he's really messing up your property. You really don't need that kind of a problem. And finally, I want to just follow up on the emergency fund idea. One, I think a really good place for emergency funds would be just a money market fund, and I would recommend the Vanguard Prime Money Market Fund. Go to Vanguard.com, and just they'll have a whole list of funds there. And look at Vanguard Prime. It's $3,000 minimum to open. It's yielding right now about 1.6%, which is one of the higher yielding ones. And as the Fed increases interest rates this year, which is a virtual certainty, that 1.6 will probably end up well over 2% this year. And it's really risk-free, virtually risk-free money, and you could even write checks on the account.
And there are literally billions and billions of dollars in the Vanguard Prime Money Market Fund. It's one of the most well-known and largest money market funds in the country. Does that help you out?
This is exactly what I wanted to hear. So many people, I think, especially in the Midwest, are so fixated on getting a house that even financial advisors have been telling me, well, you don't have a house, you know.
No, so not if great. You're going abroad. You're 29 years of age. The world is your oyster, so just enjoy it.
Thank you. Just one more quick question about the emergency funds. What percentage or how do you figure out how much should be in the – is it two months' income?
Here's my bogey. My bogey is 3 months of expenses.
Yeah,
not 3 months of income, 3 months of expenses. Whatever you spend in 3 months, get that into a money market fund. That's an emergency backup fund.
Perfect. Thank you so much. You've answered all my questions.
Okay. Thanks for the call, and good luck.
Bye.
We have just about 5 minutes left, and we have another listener on line number 4 in Charleston. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I'm trying to get some information on a 529 funds for grandchildren's college education.
Yes.
And I got some material from Vanguard, and I just don't know where to start, how to select which state to go to and that kind of thing. Is there any book or any place you'd suggest I do some research for this?
You know, you can go to the web, and essentially if you Google in 529 plans, and I can't think of the website, but there's a great website, I think John has it, that tells you about each state's 529 plan. Now, if you're an Illinois resident, this is what I would tell you.
Yeah.
I really like College Illinois, prepaid tuition. I don't like BrightStar. They have two programs. One is you can buy into prepaid tuition and you put the burden of future tuition increases on the state. I love that one, especially where tuition is rising at 6 to 7% a year. So that's a great program. And even if your grandchild or child does not go to an Illinois school, that money that accumulates still can be utilized for other schools out of state. That's one program.
College Illinois is the one that we should look into. Well,
I would look into that. It's called College Illinois, and you can go to collegeillinois.com.
Okay.
That's the website. Now, I like the Vanguard program also, where you can invest money. The money can grow in a 529 plan, and then not only could you use it for tuition and fees like the College Illinois program, you can use it for books and housing, et cetera, which is actually more expensive than the tuition and fees. So you need to be doing both. Now, John, I know you want to jump in.
Yeah, there's one website I can direct you to. It's called, this is all one word, savingforcollege.com.
Okay.
That's it.
Yeah,
this is
probably the best website.
Savings for college.
Yeah, savingforcollege.com, and it's run by, it was started and run by a professor, Joseph Hurley, I believe, from Indiana, I think.
Okay.
And it's a great website. He covers all 50 states and other programs.
Do you think these are good programs, or is this the service fees high and the risk too great, or what? I'm just wondering the disadvantages of these different plans.
You can't go wrong with Vanguard. The fees are quite reasonable, but the most reasonable you will find.
Okay.
Maybe David could address the College Illinois one.
No, very, very small administrative expenses. I love that program because you're shifting the tuition inflationary risk to the state.
Okay.
I love that program.
Okay. And also in terms of taking risk, you know, with Vanguard, you have so many choices, it's bewildering.
Mm-hmm.
But you can certainly just choose a very low risk a mutual fund within the Vanguard group, maybe a short-term bond fund or maybe a stable value fund or something which guarantees you maybe a 3 or 4% return. So that's the way around the risk. Just you know, choose the most conservative and virtually guaranteed fund that's being offered.
And you'd suggest we keep control of it then. The kids won't be able to access this except for college.
Well, generally it is set up with the child's Social Security number, but there is a custodian, so you basically would control those decisions. But remember, mm-hmm. when that child reaches a certain age, that child has access to those funds.
Yeah.
That's okay. That's okay, though.
You think that's the best, these 529 plans in College, Illinois, are the best route to go then?
That would certainly be a very good route to go.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. And we're out of time, so we're going to have to stop. Our guests have been David Sinnott, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois, and he joins us once a month, always on the third Friday, to take your questions. Also, special guests joining us from the University of California, San Diego, John Masetich. He's also an adjunct professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. And glad to have both of you with us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Lots and lots of fun. And, Jack, have a great day and a great weekend.
Thank you.